Hello and welcome back to History by Hollywood, a podcast series that examines the real events and people behind fact-based movies. This is episode 67, The Insider, part 3 of 3. We hope everyone had a great Christmas and we hope you all have a great new year, which should be coming up very shortly, depending how early after its publication date you actually listen to this. Either way, just to remind you, where we left off at the end of part 2, Jeffrey Weigand had been warned by Lowell Bergman that his interview may not see the light of day, it may not be aired, because of the pressure that CBS News and the 60 Minutes team were coming under from CBS corporate management and all the legal threats that Big Tobacco and Brown and Williamson in particular were bringing against them. So we'll just be summarising those final scenes with Jeffrey Weigand hanging up the phone and being quietly furious with what he'd just been told by Lowell Bergman. Now, in the best traditions of History by Hollywood, we do like to go into the main part of the show with a little bit of a musical interlude and trying to find something appropriate. I've gone for a bit of a tenuous link, but if you were driving to the cinema on the weekend it was released in 1999, you may have heard this on your radio as it was the US Billboard number one at the time. So take it away, Santana and Rob Thomas.
They go with that.
Yeah, this again, in Maine, very good. But the alternate version of the piece with Jeffrey's interview removed had actually already been edited by Lowell Bergman, but he prepared it for his bosses to show them how toothless the show would be without it. He was then horrified. They went, yeah, no, that's much better. He's like, no, it's not. It's rubbish. The proposed sale of CBS to Westinghouse really was going through at this time. And according to Marie Brenner's original article, was going to net Ellen Kaden, the character's called Helen Caparelli in the movie, the general counsel, around $5 million and was going to make their owner, Larry Tisch, $1 billion. So Lowell Bergman may not have been far off the mark when he suggested that. The Mike Wallace agreement with the bosses seems a bit off kilter. It doesn't appear that he openly agreed that they should put out a toothless version, but he and Lowell Bergman did have a bust up over the Weigand situation. Bergman flew down to see Jeffrey Weigand and warned him things may not be running smoothly when he was called by a CBS lawyer and told, get out of that house. So at this stage, Weigand was still living in his own house, and Lowell Bergman realised, okay, my people are not backing me up. Mike Wallace claims that when the decision not to air the Weigand interview was taken, he had to call Jeffrey Weigand and tell him, he says, because Lowell didn't have the heart to do it.
Yeah.
Which you could interpret as saying, having a bit of a dig and saying Lowell Bergman didn't have the guts to do it. But so the two of them, who'd been absolutely hand in glove throughout the period of 60 Minutes, did have a fallout over it, which seems to have, for once, apparently they argued like father and son a lot anyway, but would always end up on the same page. This time it does seem that irreparable damage was done to their relationship.
But again, overall, a very accurate portrayal in the tone, if not the precise facts of the period.
Yep.
Okay, so back to the movie, we see a lady being approached by an investigative reporter knocking on her door, and he addresses this lady as Mrs. Weigand. She says she hasn't been known by that name for some time, and he starts talking to her about her multiple sclerosis and her daughter. But before we find out what this is all about, we see the lady is, this Mrs. Weigand is not Leanne, and we see a man in an office talking about not allowing the good name of Brown and Williamson to be dragged through the mud by a man who abandoned his first wife and is a convicted shoplifter. So clearly we put it together that the tobacco magnates are going to take Jeffrey down and they're really digging into his past. In his office we see Bergman approached by Don Hewitt, who has given him a dossier on Weigand that, in his words, shows that Bergman has backed the wrong horse, and Wall Street and the Washington Post are going to run a big story on Weigand. Hewitt says that he'll only agree to run a version of the tobacco story on 60 Minutes, clearly without Wigan's interview included. Bergman is on the phone to Wigan. He's furious that he didn't tell him about his first wife. He says that he can't defend Jeffrey with one hand tied behind his back, and he should have told him everything. Bergman then gets on the phone to a contact at the Wall Street Journal, and he agrees to meet him. Later on, he's on the phone again to his own investigator on the case. This is a guy called Jack. Bergman tells him that they're trying to destroy Wigan's credibility to the point where no one will believe a word he says about anything. The shoplifting, the first wife with MS, a claim that he once said that he was on the US Olympic judo team and that he ran a red light. He says he doesn't have long before their deadline.
Yeah, the smear campaign, the guy you see in an office with a beard, and later you see Don Hewitt share a helicopter with him, a helicopter ride, which seems a little bit sort of random in the movie. The smear campaign against Jeffrey Wigan was real, and it was coordinated by a PR agent called John Scanlon, who was hired by B&W's law firm. This is the guy that we see in the office saying he won't allow the good name of B&W to be dragged through the mud. Scanlon famously employs what he calls guerrilla PR. He described Jeffrey Wigan as a habitual liar, a bad, bad guy. The shoplifting conviction's real, but in the movie they suggest it's for a tin opener, a can opener. In reality, Jeffrey says, look, it's a bit embarrassing, but I was drinking quite a lot of the time. He was driving the girls home from school, and he stopped by a liquor store to get a bottle of liquor. He had a jacket with deep pockets, and when he realised he'd left his cash in the car, rather than put the bottle on the counter, he just put it in his pocket. He said it was clearly visible, sticking out. He had $300 in the car, in a bill folder and a wallet, but he had to go out to his car to get it. A shop attendant came out, but had already called the police, and this is how he ended up getting a shoplifting conviction. You know, the truth of that, not sure, but he certainly doesn't seem to be the kind of guy. You can imagine him as a scientist being a bit absent-minded and not thinking about the bigger picture in real-life situations, but I don't think he was, you know, trying to steal a bottle of liquor. Jeffrey had met his first wife, Linda, in Japan, and again, the element's largely true. She did develop MS, and they did have a daughter born, but as Linda's condition worsened, Jeffrey withdrew from both wife and daughter, and this led to a divorce. He hadn't told Bergman about it, but tobacco investigators soon found out and exploited the story. Apparently, when he changed bank accounts, he'd missed 1 month child maintenance, but it wasn't because he chose to stop doing it, you know. But yeah, PR people can spin this. Yeah, absolutely. The person called Jack we see Lowell Bergman call is a guy called Jack Palladino, and we'll come to him in a further reality check.
Okay, well, let's continue then with the narrative. Bergman meets Charlie, his Wall Street Journal contact, and he finds that their deadline is Monday. He warns them they're being set up and some of their information is BS. Meanwhile, Bergman's people are out talking to cops and judges, while Bergman's boss asks him what the hell he's doing. Told by Bergman that he won't lie for them, the boss tells him that he won't fire him, but he should take a vacation. Mike Wallace tells him that he has a recorded piece for the news that will reveal why they're pulling some information from the 60 Minutes show and tell their viewers about the interference by their own management. Bergman is unimpressed, but Wallace says he's not going to quit in protest. Then, later, watching himself on the news, Wallace is furious to see that his interview has also been cut to a single word, and he goes into a rage about corporate interference, accusing the corporate suits and Helen Caporelli of selling them out. We see Bergman meet with Charlie, the Wall Street Journal contact, and hands him his own research results, telling him to check out and see what he thinks of his research himself. Jeffrey Wigand is eating lunch at a diner when he sees a news story on TV about himself, telling us that via the news that Wigan is a shoplifter and failed to pay child support and is now a teacher at DuPont High School. His life is being rapidly ruined in front of him. At home, watching the TV again, we see the Mike Wallace piece that he clearly wanted aired the first time, and cut to Wallace watching it himself. In it, he reveals that they have evidence about the tobacco industry supported by an expert insight witness, but they're unable to broadcast that evidence due to a confidentiality agreement, and that CBS may be faced by a multi-million dollar lawsuit. We see Wallace call Bergman, who is at a beach villa, and asks him what he thinks. Bergman says he thinks it was a disgrace. Calling Jeffrey at his hotel, Bergman doesn't get an answer, so he calls the hotel manager to go check on Jeffrey. They crack open the door and we see Jeffrey alive, but sat, almost catatonic, on a chair, picturing his children in their gardens as if they're on a TV screen. He's having a bit of a fantasy scene now. Bergman eventually gets the hotel manager to get Jeffrey to speak to him on the phone, but he's furious that Bergman manipulated him into all of this, and now he's let him drop. Bergman says that he's fighting for him still and asks where he's going with this conversation, clearly worried about Jeffrey's state of mind. They both seem to end the call much calmer, but Bergman goes back inside and talks to his wife, what has he done and what he's going to do, and wondering what he's going to do. She says that he should know what he's going to do before he does it, but appears to give him support for whatever he wants to do.
Yeah, you get the feeling this is... there's quite a lot to unpack there. The Wall Street Journal had been fed a large dossier on Jeffrey Wigand by John Scanlon and the smear campaign team, as had the Washington Post and other national papers. Scanlon did genuinely often share a helicopter with Don Hewitt, the 60 Minutes executive producer played by Philip Baker Hall, and a scene in the movie shows it, although it doesn't identify Scanlon by name, he just refers to him as John. The reason for this is they both had houses in the Hamptons, so they get to work in New York by helicopter. And at one point, as shown in the movie, Hewitt tells Scanlon he's full of crap. Scanlon's guerrilla PR, as he called it, had backfired and he'd overplayed his hand. So a team of investigators had made... They'd got these bits about his ex-wife, the shoplifting, but they'd exaggerated them to ludicrous levels and muddied the water of the smears that might have held up. So the Wall Street Journal published many of the claims in a story, but at the same time dismissed them and identified the whole campaign for what it was, which immediately won Jeffrey Wigand the public sympathy. He was seen as the little guy standing up to bullying corporations. The role of Lowell Bergman is slightly exaggerated. He didn't have a sneaky meeting with a reporter and pass him a dossier, but he was involved on the sidelines and he was definitely on side with the counterattack. He did recruit Jack Palladino and his wife, who were a two-person team, but they were paid by Richard Scruggs to refute the Scanlon campaign, and they did a fantastic job. The atmosphere inside the 60 Minutes team had become toxic by this stage. There were factions forming around the various antagonists. And whilst we mentioned earlier Mike Wallace doesn't appear to have sided with Don Hewitt, he did fall out with Lowell Bergman. But his piece about, we had this story, we wanted to show it to you, but our corporate management have decided for the first time in CBS's history to stop us from broadcasting something, all that got cut to him being asked by the talking head, you know, is it true that you have an interview but you can't air it due to management pressure? He says, yes. And that's all that's seen. And he went absolutely bats, and he went straight for Alan Caden and what he saw as corporate interference. This is Alan Caden, who in the movie is called Helen Caporelli. And he accused her of all sorts of things, and according to some accounts, he made her cry, although she denies that. Jeffrey did accuse Bergman of manipulating him. He seems to have been, Jeffrey, this is, racked with guilt over his absent children, the breakdown of his second marriage, and fear over threats to him and his family. He must have felt very alone, whatever reassurances Lowell Bergman was giving him. In reality, Lowell Bergman said he wanted to resign, but he didn't, because if he did, Jeffrey would have been left completely without cover. And I think that's a bit the same with Mike Wallace. It was like, if I resign and storm out in protest, I'm just going to be an ex-employee of 60 Minutes and they'll bring someone else in. So, yeah, it's...
But it's so, and as you say, they've compressed a few characters and action and scenes into, you know, a compressed version of the truth, but it rings true, don't you think, generally?
No, absolutely, yeah. No, I mean, it's 90% spot on, and I think where they've... Like, as the real Lowell Bergman said, they've given me credit for things I didn't do, but it just saves them introducing another character, having to have another actor, it's another name for people to remember. So it's been simplified, but nothing's fundamentally been changed.
So back to the movie, we're suddenly in a mountainous scene in the snow, and we see Bergman driving a four-wheel drive, and he stops to make a call from a phone box. He's speaking to Richard Scruggs, the Mississippi lawyer, who tells him that the Mississippi governor is suing his own attorney general to stop the action against Big Tobacco, and he needs the Weigand interview to go to air. Bergman is honest and says that he thinks it's unlikely to happen, and he's just out of moves. He then goes into a cafe, and Bergman meets a couple who say that they're on a geology survey. But he leaves this couple and immediately calls an FBI contact, and we see that something is going on. We're a bit confused as to exactly what it is, so hopefully we'll learn soon. We then see Bergman watching a recording of Jeffrey Weigand's interview with Mike Wallace and looking very thoughtful. Appearing to arrive at a decision, Lowell calls a friend at the New York Times with a possible story about CBS Corporate telling CBS News what is and isn't news. He then calls another colleague, that Debbie from previous scenes, and asks her to find out some information. Lowell then calls his New York Times friend, who asks if he's sure he wants to do this. They start to talk with the reporter, asking questions, and if Lowell doesn't tell him he's wrong, he knows he's right. So we've got this tortured scene with Bergman is sort of going public on the shenanigans and pressure that CBS is putting on them not to report what they've been investigating in 60 Minutes.
No, absolutely. It's a very clever scene, and you've got this reporter saying, so your bosses, worried about this corporate takeover being damaged, have said to you, you can't run this story, in the silence. And he says, Lowell, are you telling me I'm right? He said, have I told you I'm wrong? Have I told you you're wrong? And it's like, wow. Richard Scruggs was involved in the situation throughout the period, probably a lot more than the movie shows. So they were constantly in contact with Richard Scruggs. The scene in the snow, it's about the imminent arrest of the Unabomber, but it also, I guess, shows us that CBS News had other fish to fry than just Jeffrey Weigand. But it's a slightly strange scene of Bergman was on the forced vacation on this, you know, tropical beach, and then suddenly he's driving a 4x4 through the snow. And just as an aside, just out of interest, that scene was shot in July around Big Bear Lake, that was masquerading as Montana, where it was meant to happen. And a British company was employed to spread 15 tons of biodegradable fake snow.
Wow.
To make it look realistic.
I don't think it was worth the effort, do you? It's a bit of an estranged aside, as we've said.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of think if you ever saw a director's cut that was 4.5 hours, it might be seen in a greater context, but I don't know.
Okay,
don't know.
So back to the movie. We see Mike Wallace with a copy of the New York Times in his hands, arriving at Lowell at Bergman's hotel room at 5 a.m. They argue about morals, ethics, etc., and Wallace tells him that he's not thinking about corporate responsibility, but about his legacy. Wallace says that he's 78 and is thinking about how he'll be remembered, and he's aware that people generally remember what a person did most recently. The New York Times has run a story, and in the editorial, and the editorial of the New York Times accuses CBS News of betraying the legacy of legendary newsman Edward R. Murrows. Wallace then leaves. Debbie then calls Bergman, saying that the Wall Street Journal has run a story about the smear campaign against Jeffrey Weigand, quoting Richard Scruggs and others. Then we're back in the 60 Minutes office. Don Hewitt is being harangued by Bergman and now Wallace for caving in to corporate interests. And we've got a clip of that now.
Yeah, and for fans of Al Pacino who are thinking he's not got really ranty yet, well, here it is.
This news division has been vilified in the New York Times, in print, on television, for caving to corporate interests.
New York Times ran a blow-by-blow of what we talked about behind closed doors. You f***ed us.
No, you f***ed you. Don't invert stuff. Big Tobacco tried to smear Weigand. You bought it. The Wall Street Journal, here. Not exactly a bastion of anti-capitalist sentiment, refutes Big Tobacco's smear campaign as the lowest form of character assassination. And now, even now, when every word of what Weigand has said on our show is printed, the entire deposition of his testimony in a court of law in the state of Mississippi, the cat totally out of the bag, you're still standing here debating. Don, What the hell else do you need?
Mike, you tell him.
You f***ed up, Don.
Yeah, the bit at the end of the of that clip has Mike Wallace sort of saying, or Don Hewitt says, Mike, you, it's very quiet, but he says, Mike, you tell him. And he turns back to Don Hewitt and says, Don, you messed up. He doesn't use the word messed, he swears, but...
Okay, so back to the action. Now we're cut to Kentucky, where we see Jeffrey in class teaching his students, so he hasn't lost his job, or at least not yet. Bergman heads home as we cut to Jeffrey making tea for his daughters, who are visiting, and we see a TV show, TV showing Wallace, telling the viewers that CBS management wouldn't let 60 Minutes broadcast the original interview with Dr. Wigand, but things have changed, and now we get to see the full show going out as we cut from Bergman waiting in an airport to fly back to his family, Jeffrey smiling at his daughters, and Mike Wallace in his office, looking content. We've got a clip now that starts with Russell Crowe as Jeffrey Wigand and then Christopher Plummer as Mike Wallace. Then you'll hear the real Mike Wallace speaking to the end of the short clip.
We are in the nicotine delivery business.
And that's what cigarettes are for.
Delivery device for nicotine.
Put it in your mouth, light it up, and you're going to get your fix.
You're going to get your fix.
Wigand told us that his employer, Brown and Williamson, B&W, manipulated that nicotine fix. Not by adding nicotine, but by enhancing its effect by putting dangerous additives like ammonia into cigarettes.
Then we get we see Bergman getting a call from his FBI contact, the guy he spoke to earlier in the movie about the two dodgy FBI agents, and we find out that the snowbound drive he took was to check out the imminent arrest of the Unabomber, a story that was running alongside what we've been watching. Back at work the next day, Bergman and Mike Wallace have a chat. Mike Wallace, you can see, is sort of thinking, okay, well, we've had another fallout, but everything's good now. And Bergman then tells him that he's quitting. And again, we've got a short clip.
That Canada story still interests you?
Everything interests me. I quit, Mike.
Come on. It all worked out. You came out okay in the end?
I did. What do I tell a source on the next tough story? Hang in with us, you'll be fine, maybe. No. What got broken here doesn't go back together again.
And that's, again, it was quite quiet, but the really telling bit is when Bergman says, the things that got broken here can't be put back together. And you realise that, you know, he's, for the first time, he feels... our bosses are not going to let us run and trust our, you know, our reporters, our journalistic instincts. And I can't make promises. And we said at the beginning, he'd always been adamant he would not make promises he couldn't keep. This time, he'd found himself in a situation where someone else, you know, forced him or removed his ability to keep the promises he'd made to Jeffrey Wigand. Now, in the end, it kind of worked out, but... yeah, not great.
Yeah, so wrapping up, the movie's wrapping up now, and we text on the screen telling us that, quote, subsequent to the events dramatised here, the tobacco industry in 1998 settled the lawsuits filed against it by Mississippi and 49 other states for $249 billion. Although, based on a true story, certain events in this motion picture have been fictionalised for dramatic effect. The source of the death threats against the Wigands was never identified, and no one was ever charged or prosecuted. In 1996, Dr. Wigand was named Teacher of the Year in Kentucky. Currently, he lives in South Carolina. Lowell Bergman is a correspondent for the PBS series Frontline and is on the faculty of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. End of movie.
Yeah, so quite a lot there. Going back to the Mike Wallace with a copy of the New York Times, the New York Times did accuse 60 Minutes of betraying the legacy of Ed Morrow. And for those who may be unaware, he was the original host of a show back in the 50s called See It Now, which was seen very much as the forerunner of 60 Minutes. And it was on that show that Ed Morrow and his team took on Senator Joseph McCarthy, the man most associated with the hunt for suspected communist sympathisers such as Donald Trumbo, as covered in our Trumbo episode of History by Hollywood. The conflict with McCarthy is brilliantly told in the movie Good Night and Good Luck, which was Ed Morrow's signature sign-off at the end of each show. We'll almost certainly cover that in a future episode. It was a pet project of George Clooney's, who produced and directed the movie, and he did feature in it, although only a small supporting role. But it's really well worth a watch. And it's a similar sort of story of, oh, dare we go up against this guy who's got so much, not in Joe McCarthy's case, not so much money, but certainly influence. He was, you know, busy ruining people's careers. In reality, Lowell Bergman did quit after the Wigan events, although those events ran quite a lot longer than shown in the movie. The stories of management and corporate interference is one that resonates today and seems almost accepted as inevitable. I mean, one reason cited for Larry Tisch wanting to sell CBS News, the news division, was that he realised he couldn't influence the stories they run. And as we mentioned earlier, in retaliation of this realisation, he slashed their budget. Lowell Bergman, we've already said he's been accused by some people of rewriting history to take a larger helping of the credit, but he never claimed anything he didn't do, and that's really the movie just changing things, simplifying. Mike Wallace, who was 73 at the time of the events portrayed, he continued to work for 60 Minutes until 2006, when he became a part-time reporter, and his last CBS News interview was with retired baseball star Roger Clemens in 2008. He died in 2012, aged 93. So, yeah, so maybe he wasn't quite as old as we thought.
Maybe. Did you know that he got his start in radio, not surprisingly, and one of his early sources of income was doing ads for Ambassador cigarettes?
Well, isn't that ironic? Yeah. I mean, he clearly was a veteran reporter. He did hate the movie, partly because it portrayed him as caving into the bosses when it's clear that's not quite what he did. But Lowell Bergman says that his main gripe was that the movie opened the doors to the behind-the-scenes work at CBS News and at 60 Minutes, and that by this stage of his career, Mike Wallace was relying on other reporters' legwork. He was no longer getting down and dirty himself. I mean, I think we can forgive him that, considering his age and his background. But Lowell Bergman's adamant that it was Mike Wallace's ego that was offended by the movie. Last January this year, Lowell Bergman retired as professor at the University of California, Berkeley, but a month later returned as Professor Emeritus, which is, I believe, that's like a retired person who works part-time, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Can get called in for special lectures and things like that. It's more good publicity for the university than actual good for teaching hours or anything like that. But yeah, it's an honorary title and you will do a little bit of work every now and again.
Yeah, he's now 74, roughly the same age as Mike Wallace was during the Jeffrey Wigan interview era. Jeffrey Wigan himself, at the time of the movie, he was living in South Carolina. He now lives in Michigan and he's still campaigning. His latest target is Joop, an e-cig brand that a year ago sold 35% of its stake to the owner of Philip Morris USA and has been accused of targeting children with candy-flavoured vaping liquids. You can visit his personal website at jeffreywigan.com to find out what he's up to these days. He's on his third marriage. He's married to Hope Elizabeth May, an author, philosopher and lawyer who is a professor at Central Michigan University. In summary, I mean, it has to be acknowledged, in a pursuit of what he believed to be the right thing to do, Jeffrey Wigan gave up a huge salary, lost his family, was smeared up and down the press, even if he was eventually vindicated. And as we said, I think what the movie does brilliantly, it shows true courage, true bravery, because he was terrified and yet he still did it. And I think the scene outside the building in Mississippi where he stood by the sea and he's staring out to sea and he's thinking and he obviously racked with indecision, and he says to Lowell Bergman, I just can't find a criteria to decide. Like, he wants a mathematical formula to tell him whether he should go ahead or not. And then he just goes, he becomes instantly human. He goes, screw it, let's go to court. And they go, this is now joining Hidden Figures as movies I probably wouldn't have watched, especially when I saw how long it ran. And I'm so glad I did, because the human portrayals are real. No one's perfect. I suppose if anyone's a hero, you'd say it's Lowell Bergman, because he doesn't He doesn't sacrifice his principles, and at the end he does walk out, and he genuinely did that. He also headed up Frontline, which is a public broadcasting investigative journalist, investigative reporting television program. He helped produce that, and I think he still does. So, and you can find interviews with Lowell Bergman. He's a funny looking fella, but I think Pacino captures his humour and his aggression quite nicely.
Yeah, and as we said before, it's there's no explosions, there's no love interest, there's hardly any much of a score to lift us emotionally along, but the time of the movie, well over 2.5 hours, flies by, and it is extremely entertaining. On that note, do we venture a score out of 10?
Scores on the Doors, I'm thinking really for, I think for entertainment, it's got to be an 8.
Yeah, I agree. I've written down 8 just while we're thinking about this.
Good, solid. And we're undermarking it. I mean, on Rotten Tomatoes, from tens of thousands of people, it's, I think, 93 and 96 from critics. Historical accuracy, it's got to be 9 out of 10.
Yeah, I agree. It's right up there with First Man, I think. Very, very accurate. But unlike First Man, I think tells more of a riveting story for all its accuracy.
Yeah, it's what The Favourite should have been. No wars, no battle scenes, no car chases, you know, a study of human interactions and human drama. And unfortunately for me, The Favourite just flopped. Despite fantastic actresses in it, you know, I'll watch Olivia Colman reading the telephone directory, as people will say, but that I found dreary. This was it's riveting.
Yeah.
It really is riveting.
Yeah, very good.
You know, so yeah, great. So by the time you give people hear this, the ending, Christmas will have been and gone. We'll be on the cusp of a new year, and looking forward to next time out, which will be a supplementary with me flying solo, looking at, this is thanks to Dr. Phil Pomerantz, looking at two of Shakespeare's historical plays, Henry V and Richard III. Now, the reason we chose these two is they're two of the highest profile movie adaptations of Shakespeare's plays, and we're looking at the Kenneth Branagh version of Henry V, because the Laurence Olivier one in from 1944, it was a wartime propaganda movie, and I'm sorry, it's dreadful. It's a bad play filmed, I think. Cardboard scenery. Branagh's is gritty and feels real, but we will be paying homage to Sir Laurence Olivier with the 1955 version of Richard III. Now, there's a Sir Ian McKellen version that came out in the 90s, around the time, I think, of Braveheart, but it's set in a fictional 1930s country, so it's a real adaptation of Shakespeare, so it has no historical veracity. So we'll be doing the 1955 version. And another reason for doing these two plays is they bookend the Wars of the Roses, which start with the death of Henry V, and then accession of his infant son Henry VI, and then lead through his tragic life, and then they end really with the death of Richard III at the Battle of Bosworth Fields.
Being Richard III, yeah.
That's Richard III, yeah. Right. So we'll be looking at those, the historic, how close the movies are to the play, and also how close the plays are to history. And it probably won't surprise you to know, not entirely.
Yeah, well, good luck with that, Martin. That's an ambitious project, and thanks again to Dr. Phil for suggesting it.
Yeah.
So on that note, I guess we should wrap it up. And
I think we should. Yeah. So, saying to everybody, we hope you had a lovely festive season, and you have a wonderful New Year's celebration, and everyone has a wonderful 2020.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of wonderfulness being spread around there.
Okay.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.